Mike Malloy. If you're a right-winger, I'm here to kick your ass up around your shoulders. If you're not, welcome to tonight's program. Glad you could make it. It is Monday, the 27th of October, or September. The temperature today in Los Angeles was the hottest it has been ever in recorded history. 113 degrees. Oh, my goodness sakes. Robert Reich, Labor Secretary under Bill Clinton, has a blog, as you probably know. He has one out that I want to share with you. It is from yesterday, about the super rich get richer and everyone else gets poor. I just love watching these teabag freaks and the right-wing scum insisting on their form of governance, which means that the super rich will continue to get richer. You people crack me up. Robert Reich writes, the super rich got even wealthier this year, and yet most of them are paying even fewer taxes to support the education, job training, and job creation of the rest of us. According to Forbes magazine annual survey just released, the combined net worth of the 400 richest Americans, 400, climbed 8% this year to $1.37 trillion. 400 people. For example, Charles and David Koch, the energy magnates who are pouring vast sums of money into Republican coffers and sponsoring Tea Partiers all over America, each gained $5.5 billion of wealth over the past year, each of them. Each is now worth $21.5 billion. And you wonder why they're trying to destroy representative government? Come on, get real. Reich goes on. Wall Street continued to dominate the list. 109 of the richest 400 are in finance or investments. Finance? Is that what they call it now? Finance. Reich goes on. From another survey, we learned that the top 25 hedge fund managers got an average of $1 billion each. The top 25 hedge fund managers last year made $1 billion. That, of course, for you right-wing idiots, that's $1,000 million. That's roughly $3 million a day. But they paid an average of 17% in taxes. Thanks to the Bush tax cut. 17%. What did you pay, you brain-dead right-winger? Huh? What was your tax rate last year? Huh? Okay, never mind. The rest of America, Reich goes on, got poorer, of course. The number in poverty rose to a post-war high. He means World War II. The median wage continues to deteriorate, and some 20 million Americans don't have work. Only twice before in American history has so much wealth been held by so few. And the gap between them and the great majority been such a chasm. The late 1920s and the era of the robber barons in the 1880s. And yet, the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003, which conferred almost all their benefits on the rich, continue. Oh, and by the way, the teabag freaks continue to scream, "More tax cuts for the rich!" You stupid, stupid people. Democrats, Reich goes on, have decided to delay voting on whether to extend those tax cuts for the top 2% of Americans or for the bottom 98% of Americans until after the midterm elections. Democrats have thereby given up a defining issue that could have enabled them to show the big story of the last 30 years, the accumulation of almost all the gain from economic growth rising to the top, and to make a start at reversing it. Will the Democrats ever learn? Quick answer, Mr. Reich, no. Longer answer, hell no. So this is what the Republicans, this is what the, what did Boehner come up with the other day? The pledge to America. And I have a little bit more about Boehner later on this evening. Oh, my God. Well, you know, we pledged the tax cuts, and we think, do you like my tan? I've spent a lot of time on this tan. We want the tax cuts to continue for the rich because they're the ones that pay me. The teabaggers. Freedom Works. Freedom Works. There is actually an organization with the name Freedom Works that is designed specifically to destroy freedom, and it's accomplishing its goal in this country. And the right-wingers and the teabags and the people who don't believe Liz Cheney should be planning her father's funeral continue to buy the garbage. You people are stupider than I ever thought. You right-wingers, you really are. A veteran Democratic incumbent facing a tough re-election challenge touted a relationship with President George W. Bush in a new campaign ad. According to TheHill.com, Representative Earl Pomeroy, a Democrat of North Dakota, released a new campaign ad emphasizing his ties to Bush at a time when most Democrats are pummeling Bush and warning that Republican wins this fall would mean a return to the Bush-era policies that have gotten us where we are. Earl Pomeroy, the ad says... Well, the ad says this. It shows Bush at a signing ceremony for Medicare Part D. And this is what the ad says. Quote, "When George Bush proposed a Medicare prescription drug benefit, Earl Pomeroy voted yes, putting seniors before a party. Earl joined Republicans to fight internet predators fighting for kids." The ad later says, playing up a bill to toughen laws against sex offenders. The spot is an unusual effort by a veteran lawmaker who was first elected in 1992 to embrace Republicans, and in particular, the dry drunk, Bush. It's astonishing. It's astonishing. Cook, and let's... Or I should say Pomeroy, that's the Democrat doing this, is facing one of the toughest challenges in his own career from some right-wing freak named Rick Berg, a Republican in the state of North Dakota. So when the Democrats should be running against the Republicans, especially the these Democratic candidates, especially incumbents, who are just urinating all over themselves and their families and the floor and their campaign headquarters out of nothing but just plain fear. They should be pointing out what the Bush crime family did to this country in 8 years and the now pulseless Dick Cheney. But they don't. The Democrats don't. As Robert Reich says, do you think they'll ever learn? Once again, the quick answer, no. The longer answer, hell no.
nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Speaking of the insanity of some of these congressional elections, Rubio, the guy in Florida, who's running for the Senate. What's his first name? Mario? Huh? Mark Rubio? I don't even know. I really don't care. But I got this email from Lawrence in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Mr. Rubio's campaign ad proclaiming that, quote, he knows what it's like to lose the country, end quote, is such an incredibly outrageous distortion of the truth. Rubio, you see, is, I guess his family is from Cuba. I don't know. Pre-1960 Cuba, Lawrence writes, was controlled by an ultra-right-wing extremist government whose policies of selfish greed and low taxes for the rich created economic conditions which imposed a plague of abject poverty on the lower classes of that country so severe that led to violent, bloody revolution and an overthrow of the very hateful and repressive government. These are the same policies that Rubio and the so-called Tea Party wants to impose on the American public. Be afraid, my friends. Be very afraid. Rubio, sure. This is what the teabaggers... we've been talking about this for a long time. The teabaggers are nothing but hacks. They are... easily manipulated hacks in much the same way. Hate to go back to the model, but what are we going to do? It's the model for the 20th century. Much the same way the middle classes in Germany in the 20s and 30s were so manipulable, a certain element of the German middle class that felt it was losing its privileges. It was so easy to manipulate by the Nazis, by Hitler's organizations. And, of course, the terrible, terrible people who were destroying the country then and who were sabotaging the country and committing acts of terrorism against the country and trying to overthrow the country were, of course, the Jews. Of course. Of course. And now it's the Muslims. Of course. Of course. So Rubio is the type of politician who knows that the people who will vote for him do not have a working knowledge of even recent history. The Cuban Revolution is what, 59, 58, 59, 60, somewhere around there, 59. That's not that long ago. A lot of the people voting for Mr. Rubio will have been alive and in high school at the time of the Cuban Revolution, in high school in the United States. But because Rubio, as all right-wingers know, Rubio understands one essential truth about the American voter. The American voter, for the most part, is dumber than a sack of doorknobs, has absolutely no knowledge of his or her own history, no knowledge of the history of the United States vis-a-vis people in countries in this hemisphere or countries globally. And because the American voter has willfully chosen to be stupid and ignorant, then you have the rise of can't use the language I like to. You have the rise of these teabaggers, or the rise of a freak like Glenn Beck, or the continuing exploitation of the country by the Republican Party without resistance. In fact, if there is any criminal enterprise in the United States right now that should be inspiring resistance on a massive scale to the point, probably, of confrontation in the streets, that organization that should be inspiring the revolt is the Republican Party and all of its poisonous tendrils that are out there, whether it is the ultra-rich or the teabaggers or the brain-dead Dick Cheney or this vile, filthy enterprise that is Wall Street capitalism. You know, you got to think, if if the much-touted capitalism can't even put together properly a goddamn mortgage on a house, if they can't even do that without causing the global economy to almost tilt into oblivion, then what are they capable of doing? Eh? They had to lie, cheat, and steal about home mortgages, for God's sake. So what about every other enterprise that this dying, putrid economic system touches? What about everything else? Oh, I know. It was Acorn's fault. Right. It was all those black people. That's right. It was all those black folks that decided, hey, let's go out there and get a house and pretend like we have income. And in the process, we will topple the world economic system. Let's go, boys and girls. Here we go. That's what the teabaggers and people like Rubio and the witch out of Delaware. That's what all these people. She's not real. If she was really a witch, man, I'd be working on her behalf. That's what all these people want you to believe. That a system, capitalism, that can't even handle home mortgages, wants to run every aspect of your life. Please.
Pissed us off, so we voted for Republicans, a form of suicide.
Republicans!
Coast to coast, the Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
25 before the hour. I'm going to completely reverse one aspect of my take on Barack Obama, and it'll. I don't know how it's going to affect people, but. I really don't care because one thing that we do on this program, we find out or come to the conclusion that a point of view that I held in the past is no longer operative, as Nixon's press secretary. It's no longer operative. What I've been saying regarding Obama and Afghanistan, then it comes time to change and to take a different approach. I have not yet read Bob Woodward's new book about, or any part of it, about Obama's wars. But Robert Perry at ConsortiumNews.com has put together a very interesting critique or outline of what happened to Obama. And he draws on Bob Woodward's reporting in this book. Some people can say that Woodward is makes stuff up. I think he has access to the highest levels of power and has ever since he and Carl Bernstein exposed the filth that was the Republican Party under Richard Nixon. But I'll stipulate that this is Bob Woodward's take, but I will go ahead and take it at face value. And as Perry writes, and this is rather lengthy, but you're not going to hear it anyplace else. You just aren't. So I want to get this out tonight. I really do. This changes my attitude regarding Obama's handling, escalating, continuing the war in Afghanistan. President Barack Obama trapped himself, Perry writes, in the morass of Afghanistan by his post-election decision to show bipartisan continuity and to keep in place Bush's military command structure, particularly Defense Secretary Robert Gates and General David Petraeus. Let me digress. I don't know how many people know Robert Gates' history. But if there's another person who has been in the command structure of the United States for a number of years who should face war crimes trials, a trial. It is Robert Gates. This guy is filthy. This guy has done more damage going all the way back to Iran-Contra, going back before that. Robert Gates is really, really corrupt. Back to Perry. After his solid victory in November 2008, Obama rebuffed recommendations from some national security experts that he clean house by installing a team more in line with his campaign pledge of, quote, change you could believe in, end quote. He accepted instead the counsel of establishment Democrats who warned against any disruption to the war-fighting hierarchy and who were especially supportive of keeping Robert Gates. The results are now in. Woodward's new book, Obama's Wars, makes clear that it was Bush's old team that made sure Obama was given no option other than to escalate troop levels in Afghanistan. The Bush holdovers also lobbied for the troop increase behind Obama's back. According to Woodward's book, Gates, Petraeus, and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen refused last year to even prepare an early exit option that Obama had requested, early exit from Afghanistan. Instead, they offered up only plans for their desired escalation of about 40,000 troops. Let me digress again. Keep in mind, Obama, his level of experience where it concerns governing was fairly limited, to say the least. His experience with the corruption that is the military-industrial power structure in this country was practically zero. Woodward wrote, quote, "For two exhausting months, Obama had been asking military advisors to give him a range of options for the war in Afghanistan. Instead, he felt that they were steering him toward one outcome and thwarting his search for an exit plan. He would later tell his White House aides that military leaders were, quote, really cooking this thing in the direction they wanted, end quote. Bob Woodward identified Gates, Petraeus, and Mullen as, quote, unrelenting advocates for 40,000 more troops and an expanded mission that seemed to have no end, end quote. The effort to box Obama in reached a crisis point on November 11, 2009, in the White House Situation Room when Obama confronted the three and complained, quote, "You've given me one option for the escalation. We were going to meet here today to talk about three options. You agreed to go back and work those up," end quote. Mullen protested, quote, "I think what we've tried to do here, Mr. President, is present a range of options," end quote. But Obama shot back that the two options were clearly unfeasible and the other two were variations of the 40,000 troop increase request. The Bush holdovers even resisted passing along a hybrid plan, so-called, that came from outside their group. It came from Vice President Joe Biden, who had worked with Joint Chiefs of Staff Vice Chairman General James Cartwright. Now, that plan envisioned a 20,000 troop increase in a more limited mission of hunting Taliban insurgents and training Afghan government forces. Woodward reported, quote, "When Mullen learned of the hybrid option, he didn't want to take it to Obama. We're not providing that," he told General Cartwright, a Marine known around the White House as Obama's favorite general. Cartwright objected, and Cartwright said, "I'm just not in the business of withholding options," he told Mullen. "I have an oath, and when asked for advice, I'm going to provide it," end quote. Later, Obama told Gates and Mullen to present the hybrid option as one possibility, but instead, the Bush holdovers sabotaged the idea by organizing a classified war game codenamed Poignant Vision that some military insiders felt was rigged to discredit the hybrid option. According to Woodward's book, Petraeus cited the results of that war game to Obama at the November 11th meeting as proof that the hybrid option would fail, prompting Obama to say, "So 20,000 is not really a viable option? 20,000 more troops to Afghanistan." Without telling Obama about the limits of the war games, Mullen, Petraeus, Gates, and then Field Commander General Stanley McChrystal agreed that the hybrid option would lead to mission failure. According to Woodward's book, Obama said, quote, okay, if you tell me that we can't do that and you war-gamed it, I'll accept that, end quote. Obama turned to Gates at one point with the complaint, quote, you have essentially given me one option. It's unacceptable, end quote. Gates replied, well, Mr. President, I think we owe you another option. But Woodward wrote it never came. According to Woodward's book, quote, at critical points in the review, the ghosts of Vietnam hovered. Some participants openly worried that they were on the verge of replaying that history, allowing the military to dictate the force levels. While Obama sought to build an exit plan into the strategy, the military leadership stuck to its open-ended proposal, which the Office of Management and Budget estimated would cost $889 billion over a decade. Obama brought that memo to one meeting and said the expense was, quote, not in the national interest, end quote. So faced with this resistance from the Bush holdovers and unaware that their war game was fixed, Obama finally devised his own option that gave Gates, Petraeus, and Mullah Musa what they wanted, 30,000 additional troops on top of the 21,000 that Obama had dispatched shortly after taking office. Obama did try to bind the Pentagon to a more limited commitment to Afghanistan, including setting a date of July 2011 for the beginning of a U.S. drawdown. Though Obama required all the key participants to sign off on his compromise, it soon became clear that the Bush holdovers had no intention of complying. Even after Obama consented to the 30,000 additional troops, Woodward reported that the Pentagon continued to push for 4,500 more called enablers who would handle logistics, communications, and other non-combat functions. Woodward cited a clearly annoyed Obama responding, I'm done doing this. You know, trying to come up with some kind of a compromise so that he could get the country out of the war. More when we come back from this break. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Rage Against the Flying Monkey Right with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. We're talking here about Robert Perry reporting on some of what was revealed in Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, and how, in Perry's estimation, according to what he has read here and Perry's knowledge of how the military-industrial intelligence complex works in this country, that Obama was intimidated or coerced or lied to into the troop buildup in Afghanistan. Perry goes on, according to Woodward's book, Obama insisted that the 30,000 troop escalation was, quote, a hard cap, end quote, and that there would be no further, quote, wiggle room, end quote. Obama added, quote, it'd be a lot easier for me to go out and give a speech saying, you know what, the American people are sick of this war, and we're going to put in 10,000 trainers because that's how we're going to get out of there, end quote, Woodward reported. However, when Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor, Thomas Donilon, noted that Gates might resign if Obama pressed for the 10,000 trainer option, Obama backed off, saying, quote, that would be the difficult part, end quote. Obama later explained to Gates that the 30,000 was the most that, quote, I'm willing to take on politically, according to Woodward. Gates continued to press for the so-called enablers, the extra 4,500. Gates said, quote, I've got a request for 4,500 enablers sitting on my desk, and I'd like to have another 10% that I can send in. Enablers or forces, call them what you want if I need them, end quote. Bob, Obama responded, 30,000 plus 4,500 plus 10% of 30,000 is 37,500. I'm at 30. Obama offered Gates, quote, some latitude within your 10 percentage points, end quote, but only under exceptional circumstances. While drawing the slightly squiggy line in the sand, Obama made clear to Gates that the only other option would be to go with the 10,000 trainers. Obama asked about the 30,000 troop figure. Can you support this? Because if the answer is no, I understand it, and I'll be happy to just authorize another 10,000 troops, and we can continue to go as we are and train the Afghan National Force and just hope for the best, end quote. Before Obama's decision to dispatch the 30,000 troops, the Bush holdovers also sought to hem in the president's choices by working with allies in the Washington news media and in think tanks. As Perry reported at consortiumnews.com, Petraeus, Mullen, McChrystal were essentially campaigning for their desired escalation through interviews, speeches, and propaganda visits to the war zone by influential neoconservatives. For instance, early in 2009, Petraeus personally arranged for Max Boot, Frederick Kagan, and Kimberly Kagan to get extraordinary access during a trip to Afghanistan. They wrote, those three, on their return, quote, fears of impending disaster are hard to sustain. However, if you actually spend some time in Afghanistan, as we did recently at the invitation of General David Petraeus, Chief of U.S. Central Command, using helicopters, fixed-wing aircraft, and bone-jarring armored vehicles, we spent 8 days traveling from the snow-capped peaks of Kunar Province near the border with Pakistan in the east to the wind-blown deserts of Farah Province in the west near the border with Iran. Along the way, we talked with countless coalition soldiers ranging from privates to a four-star general, end quote. Their access paid dividends for Petraeus. When they wrote a glowing report in the Weekly Standard about the prospects for success in Afghanistan, if only President Obama sent more troops and committed the United States to stay in the war for the long haul. Woodward's book adds that, quote, in September 2009, Petraeus called a Washington Post columnist to say that the war would be unsuccessful if the president held back on troops. Later that month, Admiral Mullen repeated much the same sentiment in Senate testimony. And in October, McChrystal asserted in a speech in London that a scaled-back effort against Afghan terrorists would not work, end quote. As Perry writes, this backdoor campaign infuriated Obama's aides, including White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Woodward wrote, quote, filling his rant with expletives, Emanuel said, quote, between the chairman, Mullen, and Petraeus, everyone's come out and publicly endorsed the notion of more troops. The president hasn't even had a chance, end quote. However, the incoming Obama administration was warned of this possibility of backstabbing by Gates and other Bush appointees when it was lining up personnel for national security jobs. Instead of taking the warning, Obama's team listened to establishment Democrats like former Representative Lee Hamilton and former Senator David Boren, both of whom were big fans of Gates. As Perry wrote in November 2008, quote, if Obama does keep Gates on, the new president will be employing someone who embodies many of the worst elements of U.S. national security policy over the past 30 years, including responsibility for what Obama himself has fingered as a chief concern, politicized intelligence. It was Gates, as a senior CIA official in the 1980s, who broke the back of the CIA analytical division's commitment to objective intelligence. What Perry is saying, from that point on, intelligence became nothing more than another aspect of the political manipulation of the truth. All right, we're going to take a break and come back. And there's more to this, not a whole lot more, but there's some history of Gates that you may or may not be aware of, and if you stick around, you're going to learn about it tonight. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Based on Bob Woodward's new book, Obama's Wars. And I think it's important to do so. Robert Perry is, along with Seymour Hersh, two of the rapidly diminishing group of investigative journalists who were fearless. They weren't afraid of reporting and investigating anything. The sort of journalism is rapidly disappearing. We have some fearless essayists who are still out there, people like Chris Hedges, among others. And the list is, you know who the names are. I don't want to omit anyone, but on the other hand, I am assuming you know who these fearless essayists are. Seymour Hersh and Robert Perry are two of the bravest, courageous journalists out there. That's why the morons on the right can't stand them. So what Perry has come up with here is he obviously has read Bob Woodward's new book, Obama's Wars, which I have not, and I'd be willing to bet you have not yet either. Woodward is an establishment reporter. He is given access to or chronicler, I think would be a better term. He's given access to the highest levels of power because the establishment knows that they may have to endure an approach that they would like to control more. That would be Bob Woodward's approach. But they also know that Woodward is an pretty much equal opportunity abuser if one takes into account that Bob Woodward is part of the Washington establishment and has been since the Watergate scandal. Having said all that, I want to go back to this. Perry, at this point, uses his own experience as a reporter and his knowledge of the CIA clandestine operations, murder, and mayhem committed by the CIA and various U.S. governments. He uses that information, along with his understanding of Gates and Petraeus and McChrystal and the rest of these thugs, to put together information that I just think it's important to know. And it's information that maybe 0.001% of the American public will ever get. So if you're still tuned in, let me continue. Perry writes, more than any CIA official, Robert Gates was responsible for the agency's failure to detect the collapse of the Soviet Union, in large part because Gates had ridden roughshod over the CIA analysts on behalf of the Reagan administration's desire to justify a massive military buildup. By stressing Soviet ascendance and ignoring evidence of its disintegration. As chief of the CIA's analytical division and then deputy CIA director, Gates promoted pliable CIA careerists to top positions, while analysts with an independent streak were sidelined or pushed out of the agency. Let me digress. Part of the myth-building around Reagan was that he single-handedly, because of his insistence on a massive military buildup, was responsible for the collapse of the Soviet Union. Anyone with a working understanding of rot that was at the center of the system employed by the Soviet Union would know that that's garbage. But that's part of the myth in the United States. This is what the right-wingers have done to try to build Reagan into Saint Reagan or the Son of God. Back to Perry. In the quote, and this is from the book Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, written by CIA analyst Melvin Goodman. Quote, in the mid-1980s, the three senior Soviet division office managers who actually anticipated the decline of the Soviet Union and Moscow's interest in closer relations with the United States were demoted. Gates got rid of them because, it didn't fit into the right-wing game plan in this country. Endless profit from endless war. Perry continues, inside the CIA, there also were concerns about Gates' role in misleading Congress regarding the secret Iran-Contra operations in the mid-1980s, an obstacle that had prevented Gates from getting the top CIA job getting confirmed when Reagan's CIA director William Casey died in 1987. Plus, in 1991, Gates faced accusations that he had greased his rapid bureaucratic rise by participating in illicit or dubious clandestine operations, including helping Republicans sabotage President Jimmy Carter's Iran hostage negotiations in 1980. That was the so-called October Surprise case. And collaborating on a secret plan to aid Iraq's dictator Saddam Hussein. Now, that became the so-called Iraq Gate scandal that most Americans have never heard of. Perry continues, despite significant evidence implicating Gates in these scandals, he always managed to evade accountability by relying on his personal charm and Boy Scout looks. For his 1991 confirmation to be CIA director, influential friends like Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Boren, a Democrat, of Oklahoma, and Boren's chief of staff, George Tenet, made sure Gates got the votes he needed. In his memoir, From the Shadows, Gates credited his friend Boren with clearing away the obstacles. Gates wrote, quote, David took it as a personal challenge to get me confirmed, end quote. After getting confirmed in 1991, Gates remained CIA director until the end of George Herbert Walker Bush's presidency. However, after Bill Clinton removed him in 1993, Gates never wandered too far from the Bush family orbit, helping George Herbert Walker land a job as president of Texas A&M. During the Clinton years, documents surfaced implicating Gates in questionable actions from the 1980s. But this new evidence got little notice. For instance, the Russian government sent an extraordinary intelligence report to a House investigative task force in early 1993, stating that Gates had participated in secret contacts with Iranian officials in 1980 to delay release of 52 U.S. hostages then held in Iran, a move that undercut Carter's reelection effort. The Russian report said, quote, Robert Gates, at that time a staffer of the National Security Council and the administration of Jimmy Carter and former CIA Director George Bush, also took part in a meeting in Paris in October 1980. The Russian allegation about Gates and the Paris meeting in October 1980 also didn't stand alone. The House Task Force had other evidence from French and Israeli intelligence officials, as well as witnesses from the arms trafficking field corroborating reports of Reagan-Bush contacts with Iranian officials in Europe during campaign 1980. Now, let me digress. I think most of us who still retain a working knowledge of the Iran-Contra, so-called Iran-Contra scandal, and the rise of the Contra operation against the revolutionary government that arose in Nicaragua with the overthrow of Somoza. Most of us who retain even a slight understanding of those times know that the Contra operation was nothing more than a construct put together by the CIA. It was fake, it was phony, it was false. It was funded in large part by a cadre of former right-wing generals in this country, led by people like General David or George Singlob, who was a former high-ranking military commander. The right-wing in this country, the military-industrial right-wing in this country, will stop at nothing. I'm talking about the rise of Daniel Ortega, of course. They will stop at nothing in overthrowing duly elected governments or revolutionary governments. Ortega, if you remember, held free elections, and he was defeated by Mrs. Chamorro. Was it Chamorro who defeated him? I think Ortega got reelected here a couple of years ago. But the right wing, the militaristic right in this country at all levels, whether it's industrial, military, social, wherever, they are fascists and they want to see the destruction of this country and in its place the rise of a neo-Nazi style government.
Right now, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. We are taking a look at comments by Robert Perry regarding the new book by Bob Woodward, Obama's Wars. Perry is one of the few working journalists in this country. I could stop the sentence right there, but I'll continue. One of the few working journalists in this country who have a deep and clear understanding of the corruption that has overtaken our system of government completely and totally. No mercy, no prisoners. Now, getting back to Gates, Perry writes, Gates was also implicated in a secret operation to funnel military assistance to Iraq in the 1980s, as the Reagan administration played off Iran and Iraq battling each other in the eight-year-long Iran-Iraq war. This became known as Iraqgate, by the way. Middle Eastern witnesses allege that Gates worked on the secret Iraqi initiative, which included Saddam Hussein's procurement of cluster bombs and precursor chemicals used to produce chemical weapons for the war against Iran. Now, if you, let me digress, if you take the typical brain-dead right-wing interpretation of events, you see, somehow, miraculously, on his own, maybe through an act of God or some other sky spook, Saddam Hussein just got weaponry. Actually, as we on the left have been saying for years, it came from the United States. Gates denied, Perry writes, all the Iran-Iraq accusations in 1991, and Senator Boren's Senate Intelligence Committee never pressed too hard to check them out. However, 4 years later, in early January 1995, Howard Teicher, one of Reagan's national security officials, added more details about Gates' alleged role in the Iraq shipments. In a sworn affidavit submitted in a Florida criminal case, Howard Teicher stated that the covert arming of Iraq dated back to the spring of 1982, when Iran had gained the upper hand in that war, leading Reagan to authorize the U.S. tilt towards Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The effort to arm the Iraqis was spearheaded by CIA Director Casey and involved his deputy, Gates, according to Teicher's affidavit. Teicher wrote, quote, "The CIA, including both CIA Director Casey and Deputy Director Gates, knew of, approved of, and assisted in the sale of non-U.S. origin military weaponry, ammunition, and vehicles to Iraq." End quote. Ironically, this same pro-Iraq initiative involved Donald Rumsfeld, whom Gates replaced as Defense Secretary in 2006. In the 80s, Rumsfeld was Reagan's special emissary to the Middle East. An infamous photograph from 1983 shows a smiling Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. Teicher described Gates' role as far more substantive than Rumsfeld's. Teicher wrote, quote, "Under CIA Director Casey and Deputy Director Gates, the CIA authorized, approved, and assisted Chilean arms dealer Carlos Cardoen in the manufacture and sale of cluster bombs and other munitions to Iraq," end quote. However, like the Russian report earlier, the Teicher affidavit was never seriously examined or explained. Now, I'm bringing this up because this guy, Gates, Robert Gates, is Obama's Secretary of Defense. And as Bob Woodward lays out in his book, Obama's Wars, Obama tried to fight these bastards, Gates, McChrystal, Petraeus, Hillary Clinton, in Obama's promise to do things differently. Now, he may have said in the campaign, in order to get votes, yeah, well, the war in Afghanistan was one that deserved to be continue to fight. But according to Bob Woodward, who always has entree to what goes on these high levels, Obama's plan was to get us the hell out of there. But the military defense establishment in this country refused. Continuing, after Teicher submitted his affidavit to a federal court in Miami, the affidavit was classified, a state secret, and Teicher's credibility was attacked by Clinton administration prosecutors who saw Teicher's account as disruptive to their prosecution of a private company, Teledyne Industries, and one of its salesmen, some freak named Ed Johnson. Gates benefited, too, from official Washington's boredom with and even hostility toward the Reagan-Bush, Pappy Bush-era scandals. Instead, the polite and personable Gates continued to enjoy influential protectors on both sides of the aisle, from Republicans around George Herbert Walker Bush to Democrats like David Boren and Lee Hamilton, plus some of Gates' CIA protégés, like Deputy Director John McLaughlin, were liked by Democrats as well as Republicans. McLaughlin, by the way, was a member of Obama's Intelligence Advisory Group during campaign 2008. Are you beginning to see the pattern? The last part of this, coming up after this next break, and then we're done with it. Gates' connection. Gates' connections through all of this. And one of the reasons that Robert Gates has been giving the President of the United States lousy, lousy advice.
standing up to the flying monkey right. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. I'm quoting from an article written by Robert Perry, appearing at consortiumnews.com. A critique, in a sense, of a part of Woodward's book, Bob Woodward's new book, Obama's Wars, wherein Perry makes it very clear, at least he makes it clear to me, I don't know, maybe not so clear to a lot of other people, that one of the reasons Obama has made some of the decisions he's made regarding the war in Afghanistan is because of the bad advice, the lies, the duplicity, the intimidation that has been forced on him by people like McChrystal, Petraeus, Gates, and a few other people. Mike Mullen, head of the Joint Chiefs now, and to a lesser degree, but certainly to some degree, Hillary Clinton. Back to the final part of this article written by investigative reporter Robert Perry. Gates' connections and his timing served him well when he was placed on the Iraq Study Group in 2006, along with its co-chairs Lee Hamilton and Bush family lawyer James Baker. By the fall of 2006, the ISG, Iraq Study Group, was moving toward recommending a drawdown of U.S. forces in Iraq. Meanwhile, George W. Bush found himself in need of a new defense secretary to replace Rumsfeld, who had grown disillusioned with the Iraq War. Though Rumsfeld was viewed publicly as a hardliner, privately he sided with his field commanders, Generals George Casey and John Abizaid, who, in favoring a smaller U.S. footprint in Iraq and a phased withdrawal, Rumsfeld put his views in writing on November 6, 2006, the day before congressional elections. With Rumsfeld going wobbly on the war and the Republicans doing badly in the polls, Bush turned to Gates, and after getting Gates' assurance that he would support Bush's intent to escalate the war, not wind it down, Bush offered him the job of Secretary of Defense. Rumsfeld's firing and Gates' hiring was announced the day after the November 7 elections and were widely misinterpreted as signs that Bush was throwing in the towel on Iraq. Rumsfeld's memo was disclosed by the New York Times on December 3rd, 2 days before Gates was scheduled for his confirmation hearing. But Democrats on the Senate Armed Services Committee were so enthralled by the false narrative of Bush tossing over the ideologue Rumsfeld in favor of the realist Gates, that they took no note of what the real sequence of events suggested, that Bush was determined to send more troops. Gates was whisked through to confirmation with no questions about the Rumsfeld memo and with unanimous Democratic support. Senator Hillary Clinton and other senior Democrats praised Gates for his candor. Within a few weeks, however, it became clear that Bush, with Gates' help, had bamboozled the Democrats. Not only did Bush dash the Democrats' hope for a bipartisan strategy on Iraq by junking the ISG recommendations, but Bush chose to escalate by adding 30,000 new troops. For his part, Gates joined in pummeling the Democrats by suggesting that their legislation opposing the surge was aiding and abetting the enemy. Gates told reporters at the Pentagon in January 2007, quote, any indication of flagging will in the United States gives encouragement to those folks, referring to the enemy. I'm sure that's not the intent behind the resolutions, but I think it may be the effect. End quote. And during campaign 2008, Gates also opposed Obama's plan to set a 16-month timetable for withdrawing U.S. combat forces from Iraq. Nevertheless, Gates remained a favorite of the Washington insiders, many of whom, like Lee Hamilton, Democrat, urged the victorious Obama to keep Gates on as a signal of bipartisan continuity in the war efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Apparently wanting to emulate Abraham Lincoln's team of rivals, so-called, Obama took this advice, also retaining Bush's other top brass, Petraeus and Mullen, and naming a hardline Democrat, Hillary Clinton, to be Secretary of State. For these personnel moves, the president earned widespread praise from Washington insiders who remain especially enamored of Robert Gates. But Obama is now learning a hard lesson in national power politics. Appointing people to key jobs who don't agree with your vision and who have their own political power bases can get you, your government, and your country into loads of trouble. Robert Perry, writing at consortiumnews.com. Another reason this has come up is because there have been other interpretations of what has been going on inside the Bush or inside the Obama administration vis-a-vis Afghanistan that have shown clearly and unequivocally that there has, in fact, been, to a greater or lesser degree than the term suggests, a military coup in this country. Now, a couple of people sent emails while I was sharing that with you. Reg writes, then why is Gates still at his job? And why was Petraeus assigned to lead the war in Afghanistan after McChrystal left? I don't buy this. And by that, she means she doesn't buy the report by Bob Woodward or the interpretation by Robert Perry. Roz writes, Mike, I hate to show my ignorance, but wouldn't you say that Obama had the chance to finally stop the intimidation of presidents by these cricket advisors? Does he not have the final word? Perhaps these militaristic types threatened him in some way. Most presidents, especially Democratic ones, seem to get coerced. Look how many people die, have to die, as a result. These men have created monsters in the army, like the dozen or so that took human souvenirs from the people they wantonly killed. It's disgusting. Roz. And then Sam writes, Mike, it is indeed interesting to hear of Obama's situational problems in the White House. However, I do and did not need to read Woodward's book to know that a coup of sorts took place even before the president took office. Let me say at the outset that I do hold him at least partially responsible for allowing a host of characters to take the reins of power from his hands. His Achilles heel being that he is above all a politician, and I have the feeling that he thought this would be the easier road to take to ensure the smooth installation of his policies. The moment that I heard Howard Dean had not only been dumped as head of the DNC and replaced with the less than mediocre Tim Kaine, Dean was publicly given the bum's rush, I was shocked that this president would treat the man who masterminded his ascension to the presidency like this. This was the first of many slaps in the face that we would endure as the new president took his place in history in the midst of high hopes and promises of change within the Beltway. Rahm Emanuel, named as his chief of staff, was the second sharp slap in the face. This was an immediate sign that the Clintons were moving in and taking control. Bill and Hillary are not principled losers. Obama thought they would lead him into the Elysian fields of policy success. However, nothing would be further from the truth, and I would not put it past the Clintons to be doing nothing more than setting the stage for another run for the Clinton woman for the White House. And a couple other things here. And then he says, I despise the Clintons and their minions as much as I hate the lying, thieving teabaggers. I have a bit of pity for Obama, but he could have taken a different road, and I'm convinced it was his political ego that allowed him to be trapped by this nest of vermin. Sam in L.A. I prefaced my sharing Sam Perry's article by saying I've decided to change in light of what I have been reading about the workings inside the Obama White House, a great deal of which is secret, clouded, for the usual reasons, most of which is the reporters right now, the people whose job it is to inform us, have been focusing on the freaks, the circus freaks, the sideshow, people like Angle and this crazy woman from Delaware and the teabaggers and all this nonsense, all this garbage, this human refuse that somehow has enamored the media and its class of phony reporters to report on them. And in that process, what is going on at the highest levels of government, for the most part, at least for the cable news channels and the broadcast news channels, for the most part, all this stuff has been ignored. Because it's not, it doesn't generate headlines. You know, having somebody like Robert Perry go on one of the television programs and lay this stuff out would be pointless. Because nobody would listen. After about, 3 minutes of it, like I'm sure a lot of people listening to this program tonight, once I got into it, they just say, oh, Jesus Christ, I can't take this, and switch over and leave and don't listen. Or watch, whatever the case is. Because why pay any attention to this, right? It doesn't mean anything anymore, right?
Came back, and the anchorman was saying, blah, blah. And I replied, blah, blah. And the anchor woman was saying, blah, blah. And I replied, Then I remembered, electronic media creates reality. Electronic media creates...
Before the hour, before we leave this topic and take a break, and by the way, stick around because I've got some craziness for you coming up next hour. We're going to take a look at Boner's girlfriend. You knew that would happen. You knew it would happen. And also a little bit about the Bishop Eddie Long down here, another freak who... who decided that the Lord wanted him to minister to his flock entirely differently from what it says in the Bible. Anyway, we'll get to all that. But the Obama thing, I'm getting several emails here from people who just don't buy this nonsense, that Barack Obama is as guilty as he could possibly be because he has not asserted his power as the chief executive and begun, at least, it's been 2 years he's been in office now almost, begun the withdrawal of U.S. troops from both Afghanistan and Iraq, and other things. You know, this is where it kind of bends a little bit for me. It doesn't break down completely because I do see Obama as a fairly typical corporatist who won the presidency on charisma, charm, and the fact that he is such an anomaly in American politics. Are you kidding me? But there is still something that doesn't completely connect for me. How a charismatic person like this, who... has had quite a bit of if not life experience in the political world, certainly has had a lot of experience in the academic world. He knows things, right? He understands how things work. And things do not work all that differently in the field of diplomacy or international relations from the way they work in the textbooks. War, of course, is a whole different situation. Once war begins, everything breaks down. The truth disappears, planning disappears, coherency disappears, everything disappears. And what you're left with is bloody, horrific, mind-numbing chaos. But still, there is something that tells me that Obama is not operating the way he would want to. Now, that sounds obvious on his face, but I mean a little bit deeper than that. That what Obama is doing in so many instances, he is doing because of intimidation. I don't mean somebody, you know, comes to his quarters every night with loaded weapons and says, here are your orders for tomorrow. I don't mean that at all. But the intimidation of being the president of the United States, A, B, coming up against this horrendous militaristic U.S. foreign policy that has dominated this country since 1946. And there's no way to get around the 64 years that this policy has so influenced every politician, every political act, everything that we have done on the global stage has been, to a greater or lesser degree, to satisfy this military-industrial complex. I mean, a warrior like Dwight Eisenhower, certainly no peacenik, the way Republicans define that term, a warrior like Dwight Eisenhower tried to warn us half a century ago. By then, of course, it was probably too late. But if you look at the military policies of the United States in the last half century, not a single operation had to do with the security of the United States. Not one. Every single U.S. troop, every single civilian in some other country, every single soldier, every single death that the United States has suffered or caused in the past half century had zero to do with the preservation of the United States or the security of the United States, and everything to do with the preservation or security of capitalism, predatory global capitalism as engineered by people in this country. Now, if you take a look at that statement that I just made, you can parse it as much as you want to. Cut it into little tiny slivers. I'm not talking about the right wingers. They couldn't find their ass with both hands. They're beyond talking to. I have no interest in talking to them. But progressives, Democrats, liberals, whatever you are, if you want to challenge that statement, I'm open to the challenge. But my position is clear and unequivocal to me, that part of it. So given that, it's you know, all of a sudden I start thinking, wait a second. You know, take a look at Obama. He is not a career politician. He is not somebody that came up through the ranks. Jesus. I mean, what was he 10 years ago? An organizer in on the streets of Chicago? So, while I'm not issuing some blanket amnesty to Barack Obama for you know, his failure to lead in so many areas, like health care, like surveillance of American citizens, like torture, like Guantanamo. No. That's, you know, although that may be part and parcel to this bigger picture. I do find myself thinking, wait a second, I've always thought this about him. Wait a second. What is going on here? Below the surface, behind the closed doors, behind the thick drapes that, you know, I don't have a clue about. So rather than condemn this guy with a blanket condemnation, I think from here on I'm going to think just a little bit more about what he's dealing with before I say, oh, that son of a bitch really failed us, didn't he? And, you know, you might want to do that too, or not, whatever. All right, stick around. I've got the fun part of the program coming up. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. As promised, a couple of things here that I want to cover. First of all, over the weekend, I noticed by Sunday night, I noticed all of a sudden I had, I was told that I had a whole bunch of nasty emails. Our friend in Argentina, Hernan, who runs the what is it that he is, a video website he's put together, YouTube website. He's put together hundreds of Malloy videos, and Hernan told us that he had taken about a 3.5 minute clip. We'll play it for you a little bit later. 3.5 minute clip where I suggest that Liz Cheney plan her father's funeral instead of making comments the way she made in the recent book that came out by Carl Woodward about Obama. The Cheney family by itself is a criminal enterprise. There is no question that Dick and Liz Cheney are the types that would have been in positions of extreme power in a fascist regime. Say, oh, I don't know, pick a place. Let me think. Italy in the 20s, nah, not good enough. Germany in the 30s, better. Let me think more here. Germany in the 20s, maybe the Soviet purges. I realize, unlike Glenn Beck, that the communists were not Nazis. They were communists. Right, Glenn? But, of course, Beck mixes up the terms. So you freaks who listen to Beck, and especially the people that comment on what I had to say, the Cheneys, I mean, be honest, the Cheneys would have fit perfectly into a fascist regime that was bent on genocide against somebody. The Jews, maybe not. The liberals, probably. People who are anti-war, most definitely. The Cheneys are vampires. Liz Cheney is the same as her father. Anyway, so Hernan, who does this out of Buenos Aires, told me that he put up a 3.5 minute video where I suggested that Liz Cheney ought to shut up and go plan her father's funeral. Which is true. Jesus God. I mean, the guy is among the living dead. He doesn't have a heartbeat anymore. What do you people expect? Come on, you right-wing morons. How long can he go on unless he gets a heart transplant? Or to get a heart transplant, somebody, another one, is going to have to die. I mean, hasn't Cheney done enough death? Lord. So anyway, Hernan sends an email and says, well, you probably get a lot of hate mail. I don't know. Maybe I did. I really, frankly, don't care, because I know that there are a lot of people out there on the extreme right, these morons who listen to Beck and the rest of the freaks, who take great offense when I say something that Cheney's daughter ought to be planning her father's funeral, and yet will defend until they can no longer suck polluted air Cheney's right to commit mass murder anywhere on the planet that he wanted to. This is the thing that turns my stomach about these right-wingers. When confronted with the truth, they fall back into their defensive posture of, well, he's just a liberal. Well, there's another example of hate from the left. Hate? Hate because I say Liz ought to go plan her father's funeral? I'll tell you what hate is. Hate is when you sit around with your friends in the energy business and say, you know what? You know what? I think what we ought to do here is let's attack Iraq. There's a lot of oil there, and I want the oil. I'll get George to say God's talking to him. That's easy enough to do. I just slip into his bedroom at night and whisper garbage in his ear. He wakes up in the morning and says, God, talk to him. Oh, God. Amen. Yeah. So let's invade Iraq and we'll kill hundreds of thousands of people and get the oil. Now, that's Cheney. So you right-wing freaks. Kiss my grits, okay? You can defend a mass killer, somebody that would have fit perfectly into the Nazi high command, someone who would fit perfectly into the Japanese high command. Those are the only two examples I can think of. Somebody would have fit perfectly into the American high command, which is where he fit. and ordered the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. So you scum-sucking right-wingers, listen, send as many emails as you want. I frankly don't care. I don't read them because every single one of them, I am absolutely certain, sounds like the one immediately preceding it. You people can't articulate anything. You're a bunch of brain-dead idiots. All you do is regurgitate whatever Beck or Limbaugh or the puppet Hannity or the rest of these freaks try to regurgitate. So it really doesn't matter. And I'll say it again. Liz Cheney ought to get off her high horse and get busy planning her guest list of all the people who want to parade by her father's coffin and go, oh, he was a great American. Oh, he defended freedom. Oh, what are we going to do? So to you red staters, you right-wingers, whoever you are who enjoyed the video, again, go to hell. Just go to hell. None of you contribute anything to this country. You are takers. You suck up oxygen that normal people could be breathing. Man, you will defend a mass murderer. You will defend a mass murderer, someone on whose watch 3,000 people in this country were murdered. And when somebody makes a statement like Liz Cheney ought to shut up and go plan her father's funeral, you all start crapping your pants. Ah, I'm going to send out Mike Malloy an email. Go right ahead. Go right ahead. A bunch of jerks. Jesus. Go defend as many mass murders as you want to. And here's the thing. Most of the people on the right in this country would have defended Hitler. And probably do now, secretly. Well, what's wrong with murdering a bunch of Jews and gypsies and liberals and unionists? Anything wrong with that? I don't know why everybody's getting their bloomers in a wad about something that happened 70 years ago. Well, what's the problem? I understand you people. And that's why it is so easy to jerk your chains to the point where you all screech and scream and spittle starts flying out of your mouths. And you send emails to me. Fine, keep it up. I'm sure they're entertaining to the 18-year-old interns that we have look at them. And then send you a form letter in return. Oh, my God. So anyway, I just thought I would mention that. We're going to play it bottom of the hour. I think I'm going to have Kathy replay it. It was last week, wasn't it? Wasn't it last week? We'll replay it for the right wingers who miss it. About 3.5 minutes long, and it's clear, precise, and exactly on target. And that's why Hernan wrote to me and he said, "Hey, it might go viral." Okay, that's fine. Hernan knows what to pick. He knows how to jerk these right wingers around too. So, here we are in the silly season of. These right wingers are like dogs on chains right now, and they're waiting for these elections, November 2nd. Oh, when we take control again, we're gonna do more wars. We're gonna do more death. Goddamn that Malloy, that peacenik creep. He's a stoned out hippie. Yeah, did you see on the video? Look how old he looks. Ah! All right, enough fun and frivolity. And we'll play it for you again. So for you, you brain-dead right-wingers, if you want to hear it again, quick, get on the phone. Do you know how to use the phone? Send an email to your friends and say, some bitch, you're going to play it again. Yes, we're going to play it again. So stick around. The bottom of the hour. When we come back, now it's John Boehner. Oh, my goodness, John. Now we know why you keep going to the tanning booth.
microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So, John Boehner, apparently, you kind of knew this, didn't you? Huh? You've had a sneaky suspicion. Anyone who is as toxically narcissistic as John Boehner would have to have somebody in the background, boys or girls, men or women, stroking his toxic narcissistic personality. Has to. It is clearly evident. Every time this guy opens his mouth, he's not just a representative from Ohio. This guy has an opinion of himself that is Mount Rushmore-like. He really does. So Boehner, when they came out last week with the pledge to destroy America, you know, remember the photo op where a bunch of these freaks in the Republican Party got together with their shirts off and their ties, or I mean their coats off. Yeah, they should have their shirts off. Their ties gone, their coats off, and they're sitting around a table talking about, we make a pledge to America. That's what we're going to do. And every time he talks like this. Well, we're going to make a pledge to America. We're going to strengthen the defenses of the United States. Because anybody got a drink? Where was I? Oh, yeah. So, you know, it's very hard to talk when you have lost as many brain cells as Boehner has from your clearly evident alcoholism. I mean, it's just like, oh, my God, sit down, not another one. Well, I'm going to be the next Speaker of the House, and I think everybody should understand that. What time is it? When does the bar open? Oh, holy John of Jesus. Somebody has to be feeding that kind of an ego. A bunch of somebodies. We have a case right here in Atlanta, which I'm going to get to a little bit later, I hope, tonight also, about the Reverend or the pastor, Bishop, what the hell is he? Eddie Long, who apparently, well, I'll get to it in a second. Don't let me get away from John Boehner here, because I've always wondered, why does this guy have a suntan?
Well, you know, I have a suntan because it looks good. It makes me look good. And if you ever notice that I don't have a single hair out of place on my head, you might look at my hair and think it was lacquered. It's not. I just take care of my hair. I take care of my skin. And I make sure that my hands and my face and neck are very tanned. That's the only part that anybody ever sees. If you'll notice in the pictures from the pledge to destroy America, my shirt was open, my collar, and did you notice right there that little indentation? What's that called? That thing right there on, I know it has a name, but it was very white. Now, I tried to cover that up. I got my girlfriend. Oops. I had somebody put a little makeup on that, and where was I? Oh, that's right. What time is it? When do we break here? We need a drink or a cigarette. That's what I need is a cigarette.
Well, Boehner, you got to wonder why Boehner goes through all this, right? Because he is really a nothing. He's a cipher, a blip. He is a nothing in the history of political activity in this country. John Boehner is zero. He doesn't introduce legislation. He doesn't vote. He's there to carry water for capitalist America. And he continues to con the people back home.
Well, look, you know, I look good, and I've got a tan. You know, I'm from Ohio, and we don't get much sun there. So people see me, and they think, well, I must be pretty important because God shines his sun on me or something. I don't know. What time is it? When do the bars open? I need to get out here and go get a couple of martinis. I've only had tea martinis today anyway. I had them at lunch, or was it Twee? I don't know. There are a lot of, where was I? Oh, yeah, all this stuff about my girlfriend. Well, I don't have a girlfriend. I really don't. These allegations are all over the place, Huffington Post, and somebody said they're going to be at New York Times, New York Post, blah, blah, blah. And some another one of these liberal leftists like that Mike Malloy bastard. This guy's named Mike Stark. They're all named Mike, aren't they, huh? He asked me a question about whether or not I've been cheating with Elizabeth Lyons. Well, Elizabeth's a good girl. She's much younger than I am, and she's a good girl. I'm here to tell you that no, of course not. I mean, what was the question? I'll get back to this in a second, but there's just so much out there This is the Obamaites trying to destroy me. They're trying to destroy me because they know that when is it? November. That's right, November. I'm going to be the Speaker of the House, and so they're panicked, and they're coming up with this stuff now, about Elizabeth Lyons. It's just crazy. It's just crazy talk. It's absolutely crazy talk whatsoever. I don't know. What? Oh, it's time to go. All right, wait a minute. All right, we'll,
All right, so he's been questioned about this, right? This blogger, Mike Stark, just leaped out of the crowd and said, hey, Mr. Boner, Speaker Boner.
Speaker Boner. Have you been cheating with Elizabeth Lyons?
He used to be Speaker, right?
Have you been cheating with Elizabeth Lyons?
The answer, when we come back.
Cleaning up America one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
Yes, it is.
Come on, Liz Cheney, get out there and plan your daddy's funeral.
So John Boner. Right? Man, tan man. This man hates black folk. You know he hates black folk, right? But he tries to make himself look brown. It is unbelievable. And all that cigarette smoking, all that whiskey drinking, and he would still call himself a Christian and, you know, got this pledge to America and all this other garbage crap, right? I got your pledge. Pledge to destroy America. Well, John Boner. Word has been flitting around the inner sanctum of the Republican Party in Washington. Insiders on Capitol Hill are buzzing bzzz, like a bunch of flies around a dung heap. That would be John Boner. About the possibility New York Times has an expose coming that's going to detail... It's going to detail an affair between John Boner and a woman named Elizabeth Lyons. Mike Stark, who is a blogger, got a hold of Boner, so to speak, after Boner's Pledge to Destroy America unveiling. And Mike Stark asked Boner about the accusation. This is what, according to the Huffington Post, this is what Mike Stark said. Quote, Speaker Boner? Have you been cheating with Elizabeth Lyons, the lobbyist for the American Printing Association? Boner did not respond.
I don't know. Who is that guy? Get the guy out of there. What time is it? Time? Bar's open yet? Well, actually, the bars here in D.C. never close.
Have you been cheating with Elizabeth Lyons, the lobbyist for the American Printing Association? Mike Stark later contacted Elizabeth Lyons, Vice President of Government Affairs at Printing Industries of America, to get a comment on the allegations. And she didn't provide any either. The New York Post, the rag put out by America's favorite naturalized fascist, Rupert Murdoch, the New York Post, has since caught up with Elizabeth Lyons, not Elizabeth, it's Lizbeth Lyons, and asked her about it, and she said the rumors were, interesting word this, unfounded. What does unfounded mean?
The rumors are unfounded.
Miss Lyons told the Post, quote, "As you can imagine, I was stunned by such a question. I found it to be highly insulting, particularly as a female political professional, as well as unfounded. Beyond that, I have no further comment on the matter." End quote. Well, of course you don't. Of course you don't. Let's just see what happens.
Well, now, what is this? New York Times, where's that published? In Kenya, isn't it? Yeah, New York Times is coming after me because I'm much smarter than Newt Gingrich ever was, and I have a pledge to America. Not a contract. I have a pledge. You know, lemon pledge. Call it a lemon pledge. I'm a lemon, and I'm making a pledge. A Boner spokes geek blamed Democrats in the liberal media for coming up with all this nonsense. A spokesman for Boner said, "This is bull blank." Bull blank? No, you know, this is bull blank. The American people, here we go. The American people, this creep is going to speak for me. He doesn't speak for me. He speaks for the psychopaths and the brain-dead cretins who listen to Beck, but he doesn't speak for me or normal people. This is bullcrap. The American people oppose Washington Democrats' job killing. So their desperate liberal allies are resorting to outright lies. It's low and it's dirty. Well, yeah, it is low and it is dirty, but it's all also truthful. I don't know why it's low. All Republican speakers of the House do this. I mean, think about Newt Gingrich. Come on. Think about the guy that was, what was his name? I'm drawing a blank. The guy that from Louisiana that was temporarily hired to replace Newt, and it turned out that the guy, Livingston, what was his name? I think it was Representative Livingston. He was boinking. Every time you turn around, a Republican Speaker of the House is boinking somebody, but they like to turn around and point fingers. Well, you know, my name's John Boner, and you like my tan? A lot of people say I lacquer my hair to my head. Not true. Not true. I just comb it a lot.
So a little information. You want some information on Boner's girlfriend? Alleged girlfriend? Alleged mistress? Friend? What is it? I don't know. He is Boner's married to Debbie for the past 37 years, and he's a father of a couple of kids, former member of Ohio House of Representatives, currently minority leader, U.S. House of Representatives. You know enough about him. Now let's move on to our sexy lobbyist gal. Who's Elizabeth Lyons? Who is Elizabeth Lyons? Well, first of all, she is a former public school teacher in the Chicago area. She got a Bachelor of Arts degree. She from DePaul University in Indiana. And what else? In 1998, she got into the George Washington University, candidate of Master of Arts in Political Management in 2001. She lives in Washington. She coordinated special presidential events for the White House Office of Public Liaisons. Then arrived at the printing thingy, National Federation of Independent Business thingy, where she became the Director of Legislative Services and Grassroots. Grassroots! The National Federation of Independent Business. Grassroots? Oh, yeah, sure. She was also a familiar name to many regional family and telephone companies, family-owned telephone companies and telecommunications companies, from little ones to big ones. She became a director at the Government Affairs at the United States Telecom Association. Blah, 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 blah. And her big shot came in about 5 years ago when she started working with Printing Industries of America. Printing Industries of America. And they named her their vice president for government affairs, their Washington office and lobbyist. Until now, everything looks pretty normal. So why is Elizabeth Lyons being referred to as John Boner's mistress, girlfriend, or whatever? Well, who knows? Who knows?
The pledge to destroy America is one thing, John, but, you know, cheating on your wife of 37 years is something else again. I don't know. What do you got to say, John? I mean, come on. What do you got to say for yourself? Well, you know, I was talking to my friend Mitch McConnell the other day. You know, he's the Senate Minority Leader. He soon will be the Senate Majority Leader. And we were talking about how the left-wingers are getting desperate. They're just absolutely desperate because they know that we're going to take over in November. We're going to take over in November. That's right. That's right. And, Jesus, I would kill right now for a cigarette. Any boys out there got a cigarette? No? How about a drink? I know some of you press boys carry a flask. Let's go back around the curtain and have a drink. No? All right. Let's not. Just a joke there. I'm just kidding. I don't really drink.
Don't they just crack you up? Don't they just crack you up, huh? I mean, they really do. Republican swine. They're all over the place. Bishop Eddie Long. I don't know what. He's probably a Democrat. Because as everybody knows, right? Everybody knows that all black leaders are Democrats.
Everybody knows that.
Bishop Eddie Long, who is a megachurch leader here in the Atlanta area. Lithonia, Georgia, to be more definite. Multimillionaire. He drives a Bentley, a couple of Rolls Royces, great big old mansion, and, you know, doing Jesus' work. Has this great big 30,000 member mega church out here in the suburbs. He, and now four people individually have come forward. Four male people have come forward individually and accused him of illicit sexual activity with Reverend Eddie, or Bishop, whatever the hell he is, Eddie Long. Another one of these clownish preachers. I mean, the list of clownish Republican, I'm sorry, clownish evangelical, same thing, preachers is endless. It goes all the way back to Amy Semple McPherson, right? I mean, before her. It just goes on and on and on. So this huge fool with the terrible-looking wig hat on his head, he wears a wig that most people would be ashamed to put on in the privacy of a dark closet. But Bishop Eddie wears it to church every Sunday. He stands up there. He's got these suits that has a logo of the church on his suit. You can go to his website. Just like you go to MikeMalloy.com and buy stuff, you can go to Eddie Long's website and buy clothes with the church logo on it. Amen. Well, Bishop Eddie Long, how did he become a bishop? Well, that's a long story. Bishop Eddie, well, I'll tell you more when we come back. Stick around. There's the music.
Tonight. Why can't it all be like it was? Mommy's not here anymore. 'Cause Daddy likes porno and $10 whores. Daddy gets wasted and robs liquor stores. Daddy likes rubbing against little boys on the bus.
So we have another one, don't we? Bishop Eddie Long here in Metro Atlanta. This one accused of having sexual relations with four young men who were fascinated by the ministry. Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about the Reverend or the Bishop Eddie Long as that case develops. Right now, I want to play for you what really rang the chimes of a bunch of right-wing nutballs across the United States of America. This is the clip that Hernan put up on the YouTube video page, different video cuts of this program, audio video cuts. And apparently some right-wing freak pot grabbed it and ran, which is fine. I love it. I want you right-wing freak pots to continue to grab pieces off the YouTube site that Hernan puts up and get it out there. We need the publicity. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, this is from last week. This is what really dinged the bells of a whole bunch of right-wing booger eaters. Anyway, back to Cheney, whose father is directly responsible for every single death in Iraq since the invasion and occupation that he championed in 2003. He's and that's not just Americans and the wounding of Americans, but the deaths and wounding of countless hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. He is responsible for the deaths in Afghanistan. Cheney is. He is responsible for the deaths in New York City at the Pentagon and the plane crash in Pennsylvania. Dick Cheney is one of the bloodiest sons of bitches ever to have held power and office in this government. In terms of deaths that were a direct result of his incompetence and his lies, Dick Cheney. His daughter, reading the quote in Bob Woodward's new book, the quote from the president, "We Can Absorb a Terrorist Attack," this is what she said, quote, "Americans expect our president to do everything possible to defend the nation from attack. We expect him to use every tool at his disposal to find, defeat, capture, and kill terrorists." Now, as I read this, keep in mind what her husband, or what her father, maybe it is her husband, what her father and her father's puppet did. "We expect him to deter attacks by making clear to our adversaries that an attack on the United States will carry devastating consequences. Instead, President Obama is reported to have said, 'We can absorb a terrorist attack.' This comment suggests an alarming fatalism on the part of President Obama and his administration. Once again, the president seems either unwilling or unable to do what it takes to keep this nation safe. The president owes the American people an explanation," end quote. I'll be a son of a bitch. I mean, you talk about somebody who the truth or reality is I don't know what it is, the surface of a soap bubble to this woman. I have no idea what dimension she runs her sad, tired, useless life in. But it's not the one where the rest of us live. Her father and her father's puppet, George, at the very least allowed, at the very worst, engineered the worst attack on this country since the War of 1812. And she has the audacity to make this kind of a statement. "Americans expect their president to do everything possible to defend the nation from attack." Where was your father after he deliberately authorized a stand down on a day, a time when he knew there was going to be an effort made to attack this country? I don't know why I give this psychopathic, misdirected woman. You ought to be out there planning your father's funeral, Liz, because I'm sure all the nation's bigwigs, especially the Republicans, are going to fall all over themselves to worship in front of his coffin. That's what you ought to be doing instead of making your filthy, insane, gratuitous statements about what the American people expects a president or an administration to do to protect us from terrorist attack. Shame on you, Liz Cheney. Go plan your father's funeral. Just go do that. Do at least one thing in your useless life that will have some meaning. Go plan his funeral.
See, there's just too much truth in there. There's just too much truth. There's too much order and common sense. Of course she should be planning her father's funeral. Good God, the man doesn't have a heartbeat anymore. And as far as what Dick Cheney and his puppet George did, does anybody have any doubt? I mean, anyone with still retaining the ability to make rational thought, have any doubt what these two did? But according to our two high school interns, oh, my God. The emails just rolled in over the weekend. And some of them were quite creative in their vitriol, which is fine. I love the misspellings. I love to see all the different ways you can spell MF-er. That's a lot of fun.
But the essential reality here, you right-wing droids, is the fact that everything I say on this program is the truth. I don't have to make stuff up like people on the right do. I don't have to come up with death panels or Obama was born in Kenya. You know, I mean, everything that you hear on this program is true. That's what freaks you out. You can't handle the truth. You can't even get into the same county as the truth.
Oh, wait till November 2nd. I'm John Boehner, and let me tell you something. You know, this is Mike Malloy. I don't know who this guy is. It doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't mean a thing to me, but apparently he got a bunch of my worshipers all upset with his comments about Liz Cheney and her father, Dick, or whatever. I'm not going to touch that one. No, no. So I'll tell you what. Come November 2nd, I forget what I was going to say. I think the bars are open now, so listen, we're all going to go down here to favorite place. We're all going to have a drink after a hard day in the legislature. So I'll see you later. Take care and listen to keep it lit, all right? Just keep it lit.